Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Fresh from a trip to Indianapolis to the nonprofit Liberty Fund Socratic Seminar is Dr. William Levine, who's professor of English here at MTSU. He participated in the seminar which examined a book called Restoring the Lost Constitution by Randy E. Barnett, March 20th and 21st. Mr. Barnett's book, as I understand from having read part of it, examines, from Mr. Barnett's perspective, the dissipation of constitutional rights as the Constitution has been interpreted and, in his judgment, misinterpreted by judges over the years. He looks at it in terms of the 18th century concepts of natural rights that our founding fathers used as precepts for starting this new republic. So, Bill, how did an English professor get roped into this? This sounds more like political science or history.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Jenna. I think that the Liberty Fund was committed to getting a certain amount of diversity, not just getting the few of the Brahmins in the field, so to speak. A man who actually reviewed this book for the publisher, he just astounded me. You know, a 40-year-old professor at Princeton in the political science department who already has an endowed chair, but, you know, a diversity of people from political philosophy. One woman was the Ayn Rand professor of philosophy at U of Texas, people from law school, from various ways of studying this, one associate editor from the Weekly Standard. But I think English gave the broad, liberal, artsy, if you will, humanist perspective, without my being a specialist on the history of constitutional law. I think my scholarly interest in the 18th century, in the way natural rights is so much a part of the constellation of the history of ideas then, and has been integral, of course, in the founding of this country, and so much a subject of any kind of humanist debate where we pit an individual against either an oppressive or benevolent context of a social institution. So it actually reminded me a bit of my earlier committee experience at MTSU. I was once on the Institutional Review Board, which really was set up to protect the rights of subjects in experiments, their confidentiality, their consent, which of course is an important concept in this book, against, you know, the what needs, demands, experimental progress, we might call it, of researchers. And in that board concept, in fact, English or the humanities were considered essential as a counterweight against what might be too closed off a scientific or social scientific perspective of looking to remove as many possible barriers to doing research as possible. So I suppose, willy-nilly, I've been a defendant of human rights in these different contexts.
Well, the words do matter when you are attempting to articulate what rights mean, what laws mean, what privileges mean. And this is something that people who are sticklers for correct English have been trashed about or mocked about all along as being too anal. But if you don't parse the words correctly, you could very easily end up conveying something that you never intended to convey. When it comes to natural rights, as I understand the concept, or natural law, as I learned it in political science class, we are talking about the belief that, to quote the famous document, we are, as human beings, endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And since we come by these naturally, they are not things that government can endow to us, and they are not things that government can take away. Have I pretty well expressed that concept?
I think so. If we go back to Locke and, of course, later Rousseau, we have the idea of a social contract and the principle, of course, of individuals agreeing to a government for the sake of protecting these natural rights is essential. And Barnett, as a very careful legal scholar, would naturally do, no pun on naturally there, but he believes that we never surrender any of those natural rights to our disadvantage, or at least we shouldn't be doing that. The government should not be eroding the right, say, to do whatever Locke would call our innocent pleasures, as long as it doesn't extend upon someone else's domain. And, you know, this book does try to recount a history of the lapse of those rights under what, you know, it's typically called the progressive era. Of course, there are precedents even going back to John Marshall's court around the time of the founding of the Constitution, where, you know, the courts have not been as vigilant as Barnett would have liked against these incursions for really the control by the executive and legislative branches. So, in other words, the judicial branch not doing as essential review. Of course, a lot of the book, as you said, is about the parsing of words and going back to an original public meaning. The book's original contribution there is that we're not looking at private intentions, but at some sort of publicly accessible meaning that could be recovered by reviewing the documents surrounding the ratification of the Constitution, the state legislatures as well, and going back to sources that are near and dear to me, like Johnson's Dictionary, in an attempt to fix some of these meanings and think about the way the Constitution has grounded the stability of natural rights against the incursion of government through history. And, you know, I have my quibbles with Barnett's method, even with the ways he's using Johnson's Dictionary and trying to fix meanings like necessary and the necessary and proper clause, or, you know, commerce, and limiting that to the 18th century mercantile sense of just the act of trade between two entities, rather than what we know in modern government as the regulation of, you know, agriculture, mining, business against, you know, what, environmental hazards, against labor abuses. You know, were there some original liberties that the founders felt could not be tampered with? So again, you know, a provocative, even if, like so many books driven by a thesis, perhaps tending towards some utopian ideals of preserving these inalienable rights.
Well, he seems to even have a trouble with the word interpret as pertains to the role of the judiciary in dealing with the Constitution. Ever since we attended our first civics class and learned about the separation of powers, we have been told that it is the judiciary's role to interpret the laws, to interpret the Constitution. You gather, however, he would prefer a different word, and that he thinks that judges have steered the law far away from what the founder's original intent was.
Yes, and again, he's very careful about defining the difference between interpreting and constructing a constitution. Now, interpretation implies to him some sort of a self-sustaining power within constitutional documents to ensure that the meaning does not need outward propping and support. He does take construction as something political. In fact, he had an implicit argument running with another member of the seminar about the nature of constitutional interpretation versus construction. So that would be looking at extrinsic sources to supplement what the Constitution itself could not have anticipated over history. And, you know, going back, in fact, to the previous question you asked, he does make another important distinction between natural law and natural right. So natural law is a more all-embracing philosophy which suggests an intrinsic morality in humanity, and this book is, of course, against any legislation of morality by the branches of government to pass laws just to ensure that people are, say, you know, kinder or more respectful to one another. That's going beyond what the Constitution's powers really are. So,
but as we were talking before we went on air, I brought up the term strict constructionist, and you you seem not to be of the opinion that he is a strict constructionist in the sense that Robert Bork and some other conservative thinkers of the day consider themselves to be strict constructionists. That is to say, the Constitution should be interpreted just exactly as it was written, and nothing should be read into it. There should be no reading between the lines. It should be taken literally.
Well, of course, that's impossible to do in modern age and with the accretion of historical change in our country.
Right, and the more liberal view is that the Constitution is a living, breathing document that was intended to be changed and adaptable over time, and so it has been amended and so forth to take care of consequences that the founders never could have foreseen in their wildest dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, that's why we do need that judicial review. And, of course, the author is not so naive as to suggest we shouldn't have passed the, 14th Amendment to ensure some federal power over state acts that violate, civil or natural rights. And, of course, that was in the wake of the Civil War and problems of Andrew Johnson allowing, southern states or putting pressure on them to comply with emancipation. So construction, of course, has to be done under this very careful judicial review to ensure that any legal act is necessary and proper, going back to the first articles and the later ratification of that in the Ninth Amendment in the Bill of Rights, that government power is not excessive, it's not concealing some hidden agenda, which seems to suggest to me a bit of a star chamber or witch hunt of the judicial element against Congress. But certainly, I think Barnett's concern is with procedure that ensures that principle, even while assuming we can never quite have the same concepts of, say, commerce or liberty that the founding fathers did have. So interesting you mentioned Bork's name, too, because he is actually one of the surprising antagonists of this book, if I read it like a narrative, an account of history. So predictably, the author is against excessive government flexing of its muscles in the progressive era in the New Deal, and Oliver Wendell Holmes gets debunked. Who is it? Louis Brandeis and his famous Brandeis briefs showing the need for socially progressive legislation is at first looked at as a hero when he's a good appellate lawyer, but once he's on the court, he's all in favor of making it easier for progressive and New Deal era legislation to be passed without sufficient judicial review of the limitation of individual rights. And, particularly we're talking about business rights here. We haven't mentioned the L word, Barnett's libertarianism. And, the libertarianism would go against Bork, who didn't want any judicial review, who wanted to dismantle that so-called big government and activist judges and turn things back to state rights. And Bork, of course, couldn't get through his confirmation hearings because he thought the Ninth Amendment was just an inkblot that couldn't be interpreted, as opposed to Barnett's essential defense of those privileges and immunities, going back to natural rights and granted civil rights on top of government. Natural rights actually are pre-governmental. They show, for example, the need for an impartial judge when two landholders don't recognize any kind of mutually agreeable authority. So, in that regard, preserving private rights to the nth degree while being very antagonistic towards what many people would say is modern liberalism, these kinds of progressive reforms government has enacted, make this provocative, if not entirely practical and realistic, but certainly force that kind of reconsideration of where judicial history has gone.
Political scientists will tell you that that liberalism has split off at one point into two separate divisions, one that is based on property rights, which is a traditional construction, and one which is based on social rights. And those who base modern liberalism on social rights would tell you that basing it on property rights excludes a whole bunch of oppressed minorities, not just racial, sexual, and so forth. But at one time, people who didn't own any property were considered to be citizens of lesser value than those who did. He is a libertarian. I take it from reading what I have read of the introduction here that he is not someone who would necessarily turn back the clock on everything, but there are those who would argue that even though some of the decisions of the Warren Court vis-a-vis civil rights were not strict interpretations, or rather expansive interpretations of the Constitution, and that Roe v. Wade in 1973, the abortion decision, was an expansive interpretation of the 14th Amendment, that where would the society be without those specific interpretations? So that there has to be room for something more than strict construction if the society is to grow and if the society is to adapt. Where does Barnett come down? I don't presume to know where he would stand on those particular issues, but where would Barnett stand on the need for decisions to take a broader view of, say, the 14th Amendment due process of law?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so by broader view, are we looking at stricter judicial review of natural rights, privileges, and immunities being protected? Is that what you're getting at in terms of mentioning, say, defenses of privacy, basing decisions like Roe v. Wade?
Well, I can't think of a more natural right, for example, than one's right over one's own person. Mm-hmm. Because that is what one was born with. If one does believe in a supreme being, one believes that one obtained one's own physical self, certainly through that method. And one's own body is one's own property. You did not purchase it from Sears. You did not get it from the government. So what greater example of natural right could there possibly be than a woman's right to do what she wants with her own body? Where does that leave his concept of natural rights?
Well, he is an ardent defender, much to the ire of many more hardline conservative partisan thinkers, of decisions like Roe v. Wade and a more recent case striking down state laws against sodomy, as in Texas. I believe that was the testing ground. So again, this strict interpretation would say these are individual rights to use one's body as one pleases, and, you know, assuming again that there's not any incursion upon another domain, another entity or person's domain of rights, and certainly not the government's domain of power, then these are broadly, expansively interpreted for the sake of a government that doesn't interfere with essentially Lockean rights. Now, you know, again, this split you were talking about between property and individual rights, I think Barnett is maybe nostalgically trying to split off a Lockean idea of individual autonomy against an intrusive government, of course, in the wake of the English Civil Wars and the tyranny that they were supposedly addressing but ended up replicating in many ways. That's certainly a principle our country was founded on. But the other version of liberalism, maybe with a capital L, this, you know, statism that, he even makes what I thought was a very unfair remark against the Bismarckian welfare social state that caught on in America. That's maybe coming more out of Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill and utilitarianism. Again, the justification of any act that the state does to preserve a larger number of the masses of the people in the state for social, civil protection against the incursion of profit, economic deprivations. Of course, he is, Barnett, more in favor of, say, freedom of contract. He goes back to a classic case at the turn of the century, Lochner versus the state of New York, which, the court, in his way of picking out these single heroes, like the few just men against the tide of progressive legislation, that was about bakers working more than 60 hours, whether there could be constitutional rights to limit labor hours. And I think, the book has something of a tunnel vision, not dealing with the whole issue of labor rights or that kind of exploitation citation, but just with something grounded in freedom of contract. If the banker was capable and willing to work 60 hours against some sort of regulation of labor or the employment, then there should not be state interference. You know, Holmes was a famous dissenter, but Barnett cleverly even shows how certain contract laws against the presumption of fraud could even go back to post-Civil War Reconstruction era and have protected the rights of freed African Americans at that time. So I think he knows how to set his book in some kind of tone of individual progressive rights without ever saying that the state can legislate or dictate morality.
Do you gather from the language he uses and the way in which he has written the book that he does this in order to not limit his readership, or do you gather that he is more sincere in making these nuanced passages in the book?
I think that this book is not something an average reader, even a well-educated college-level reader, would naturally pick up. People at the seminar were all telling me how accessible this was, but I felt reading every page, this is why I didn't go to law school, that if it takes 10 pages to ground some sort of etymological sense of the word commerce in the understanding, the public understanding of the founders and the constitutional ratifiers, and an argument I ultimately felt was leading to a dead end, I was not really finding it all that readable. So to answer your main question, I do think Barnett consistently through his career, actually coming out of contract law and only moving into constitutional concerns later in his career, is very earnest about and, maybe unfortunately has to depend on the protection of institutional forums like the Cato Institute, which he is on the board of or a member of, I'll get this right, senior fellow of, that's the right term. And of course, in the Liberty Fund, not a political organization, but a nonprofit for the dissemination of these ideas of liberty and responsibility. So I think at best, it's a trickle down effect into introductory law classes. And we had some great criticisms of what law school does and why we should never trust judicial review degree Barnett does among the law professors in the seminar too, in particular. I think even to take what might be a quixotic view at points for the sake of provoking argument within an institutional framework of law, of political science, and I suppose even in the humanities and in English, I don't teach it, but someone in my department does law and literature, and we used to teach legal writing, but I think we needed certified lawyers to teach them. So there's some way, even if I don't take the particular political perspective Barnett does, that the issues are foregrounded probably even the next time I teach an 18th century English literature course, I'll be better aware of this transatlantic currency of John Locke's ideas into our present day.
How much of the great thinkers' work, Locke, John Stuart Mill, Rousseau, Montesquieu, ends up in college-level English courses? I got a smattering of it in high school literature alongside American authors like Washington Irving and Nathaniel Hawthorne and so forth. How much of that finds its way into the college-level English curriculum?
Well, nobody, of course, is dictating to us how we should teach our courses in this concept, I suppose we could derive from Locke, of academic freedom, among other sources for that concept in history. But any course, I think, worth its weight that goes back to a historical era, as much as we try to be topical and relevant, I don't think we can deny that there is the intellectual background that, at least in the past, in contexts where I'm a little more confident about doing this, I've assigned selections from Edmund Burke and Rousseau, for teaching not just even 18th century literature, but say general humanities courses where we want to reconsider the relevance, the currency of these founding kinds of documents of our Western civilization that's been, beleaguered in so many ways. And, if that means we have to go back and also read Mary Wollstonecraft, I've just returned from an 18th century national conference of 18th century studies scholars. And of course, we try to go back, like Barnett does to some degree, to these original debates and issues and not just say there was one monolithic thinker, you know, even as great as Locke was in the realms of both epistemology and political science. There was obviously a context, you know, against Hobbes, against the problems of the English Civil War and establishing a republic. And, you know, I don't really teach that much American literature these days, but I can clearly see when I read the Constitution, being sensitive to intertextual echoes, this expression of law must be binding in conscience. You could go back to John Milton and think about freedom of religious conscience as this sort of secularized principle for why, as Barnett would say, we can't have a government just on majority rule or on some kind of fiction of consent. That's not enough. A law has to protect the liberties of those who dissent or did not consent to these law acts as well. So I don't know if this is answering your question, but I think it would always be better if we didn't just read two paragraphs of, say, John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham tucked in the 2,500 pages of a Norton anthology, but we did at least occasionally pick up the original tracts and documents, as, you know, I'll be doing to some degree this summer with graduate students when I teach the history of criticism, which is a grab bag of, you know, philosophy, even some leanings towards political science, and of course aesthetics. And this has been turned into some canon of great and contemporary thinkers, you know, some line of continuity there.
The reason I ask is because in a literature course, when you veer into Locke and Rousseau, people who you would read certainly in a philosophy course or a political science course or maybe even a history course, it's nonfiction. Deep ideas. This is not a narrative with fictional characters and a story arc that the reader can follow. And so do you take a different approach as a professor, as an instructor, in guiding your students through this particular type of literature as opposed to, say, a short story or a novel?
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly think even in a book that tends towards very nitpicky, you know, legalistic interpretation, my approach to Barnett was essentially to see a larger pattern of history's rise and fall and attempted recovery, even within the book, not written about a single character, but of course it has historical agents and acts in it. So, you know, if I were to teach Locke's essay concerning human understanding, his epistemological tract, I would certainly see, you know, some of his examples about, say, the sensory ability of a blind man, you know, based upon some incident in real life, as being very compelling, as being this very concrete element that backs up the philosophical terminology and distinction. You know, I think the hardest intellectual tract I've ever taught is, say, parts of Kant's critique of judgment, but, you know, even there, we're looking at what could be a grounding for fictional concepts like point of view, aesthetic disinterest in some account of how the human mind is formed and operating. So I suppose I do try to focus on micro-narratives within larger, you know, philosophical tracts, which of course proceed, very analytically and sometimes lose track of second and third level terminological distinctions. But I think there are always these elements to turn back to. Of course, Rousseau wrote, you know, novels as well as philosophical tracts. So having that kind of so-called intertextual connection. You know, one of the reasons I enjoy reading Burke, in fact, is because he does bring in examples of how a crowd would desert a theater where they witness, say, King Lear, an affecting tragedy, as well as it could be acted and performed. If they had heard that somebody across the road was being hanged, a criminal of state, they would run and see the real thing rather than the tragedy. So, again, there's this kind of, you know, sensory, what can we say, almost like a material grounding in examples and, you know, points of view and narratives within larger philosophical treatises that give it the grounding we hope makes it come across in an English class.
Yeah. That anecdote about Burke made me flash back to the quote of his, all that is needed for evil to triumph is for good men to stand around and do nothing. The quote that Howard K. Smith used at the conclusion of one of his documentaries on CBS about Birmingham during the Civil Rights Movement, which caused the switchboard at CBS to light up with Southern affiliates calling to complain. And so the CBS boss, William Paley, took him out to lunch at 21, no less, and said, Howard, you got to get on the air and apologize. And Howard said, no, forget it. And he quit. So thereby, I think Mr. Burke would have been proud.
And of course, the great Irish poet of the World War One era, I mean, he had a very long career before that and after it, William Butler Yeats, would say on the eve of the Russian Revolution that the best lack all conviction and, the worst are in power. So he was very, Burkean, even 130 years down the road in terms of understanding revolutions and why they often end in regressive kinds of political turmoil and chaos. So he had, of course, movements of Irish independence that he lived through, as well as seeing World War One break out and the Russian Revolution.
Dr. Bill Levine, professor of English, thank you for discussing political science and history and philosophy and English and everything in between here with us today.
Okay, well, thank you, Jen. I think it's true, the spirit of the Liberty Fund seminar, that we want to broaden our scope of discussion beyond the constitutional procedural matters that this book is defending. So I'm glad we could do that in a true humanist spirit today.
Interdisciplinary is getting to be one of the more popular words in discourse in colleges today. This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at this same time next Sunday. You can download the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.